Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, where we take a look at the lectionary from various perspectives to help prepare church leaders for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today, as usual, is Josh Davis and Althea Spencer-Miller. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome, everybody. Today, we're going to be looking at readings for Palm Sunday, which means in the lectionary cycle, we are getting within eye view of the end of Lent and, of course, the celebration of Easter through from Palm Sunday through Holy Week, leading all the way up to Easter. So our lectionary reflects those choices. We have the Liturgy of the Palms as three texts on which to focus as the palms are being processed around. I'm not sure how people are going to do this. We are still in the pandemic situation in the church I'm familiar with, which is a very tiny church in the Diocese of Maine. People are picking up palms a week ahead and taking them off to do things with, but everything is still online. We don't yet have enough space to position people in within a safe distance from each other yet. So, Liturgy of the Palms, however that's done, we're not going to say a lot about the texts for that occasion prior to the main liturgy, because the Liturgy of the Word would be easy to continue online. And that starts off with Isaiah 50, 4 to 9a. And this is a passage that is often identified with suffering as a collective experience in the case of Israel, and as an individual experience. And of course, that is a preface to Holy Week itself. So that will be one way of looking at it. The next reading from the epistles is Philippians 2, 5 to 11. That Josh and I have had occasion to talk about earlier this week in a separate class that we're teaching together on Philippians and Philemon. And we happen to have reached the point of discussing how this hymn is located by, presumably, Paul in the context of the Philippian epistle, in this case in chapter 2. So we can discuss it as the hymn that it is, which is one of several New Testament hymns in epistles, and possibly John's gospel. There's a possibility that John 1 is a logos hymn, a hymn to Jesus as logos. But we can also discuss Philippians as advice for the conduct or admonitions to certain kinds of conduct on the part of Paul based on the actions that the hymn describes Christ Jesus himself undergoing. So this business about not regarding equality with God as something to be exploited, this would be a model for the relationships amongst Philippians themselves, not thinking of themselves more highly than others, but taking the good of the other first. So that's one way to look at that hymn. Mark 14, the very long gospel, which takes up a long section of chapter 14, or a long section of chapter 15 as well. 15 takes us into the narrative of the crucifixion, and chapter 14 is mostly the narrative of the Markan trial. I'm going to highlight one thing, if I could, because it's actually quite important. So 14:28 is very important in the narrative life of the Gospel of Mark, because in Mark's Gospel there is no resurrection account. And 14:28, on the lips of Jesus, is a reference to being raised up. So you can see why 14:28, in the context of the whole Gospel, would be highly significant, because it portends not just an announcement from a third party about the tomb is empty, he is not here, he has been raised. That's what the young man says in 16:6. But in 14:28, this is on the lips of Jesus, and a statement about what looks like, in the English, being raised up, I will go before you into Galilee. Althea, you and I can discuss this together, but the Greek is really kind of interesting. I've said this in other contexts and so on, but not in this context of the podcast. But if you look at the form of verse 28, Josh, you will be our touchstone about how this comes across as I'm trying to explain it and how relevant this might be. It's an aorist passive infinitive. So if I were to translate it very literally, which isn't the way I'd read it liturgically, I would say something like, but after the state of having been raised up with respect to me, Jesus says, I will go before you into Galilee. And this is transformed in the English text into, but after I am raised up. So the Greek makes the passive condition, the aorist passive condition, quite apparent in the structure of that verse, where the English, you'd have to look carefully at the English translation to see that being evident. And of course, it's, as I said, a very significant verse given the absence of resurrection appearances in Mark's gospel. So I just wanted to highlight that. It might be something on which somebody might wish to concentrate. I'm not sure. Maybe we can pick up elements about the crucifixion itself in Mark's gospel. It's surely significant that after the official account of his last cry and expiration, the Greek has this verb of breathing out, the tearing of the curtain of the temple takes place. And this is a kind of a match to the opening, the tearing of the heavens in the baptism account, but it's the opposite movement. The heavens are torn in Mark chapter 1, and the Spirit comes through them and descends eis auton, onto or into him. And in the aftermath of the crucifixion, the temple of the curtain is torn into from top to bottom. And so it kind of opens up some kind of access from below to slightly higher up, not to the celestial realms, but slightly higher up. And it is followed immediately in the Markan narrative by the response of the centurion. I say response because the phrase after the English introduction to the sentence, now when the centurion, the phrase who stood facing him might be a reference not just to him, it's a masculine accusative pronoun, but a reference to the tearing of the curtain of the temple or to the hieron, the temple itself, which is a neuter noun and therefore takes the form of the third person singular. So the centurion may be facing Jesus and looking at his death. The centurion may be facing the temple from a long way away from Golgotha and looking at what is happening in Jerusalem. The response of the centurion, truly this person was God's son, is a very significant one given that Mark's gospel begins with the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, at least according to most manuscripts. Thus, for the narrator of Mark and the hearer of Mark, now at the end of the gospel, we have a pagan, a Gentile, making the claim that the narrator made at the beginning of the gospel. So there's a lot of bookends going on here at the beginning of Mark's gospel with the death of Jesus and the accompanying events around the death of Jesus. So that might be something that people would like to think about. So those are my scattershot thoughts. What should we discuss?
I have two clarifying questions. The first one is you said that the centurion may be looking on at a distance from. So what would that? Could you paint that picture for us so I could think of it a bit?
Yeah,
so I could imagine it in my mind.
So the centurion is outside the city proper, the old city of Jerusalem, on a hill at some distance, within sight distance, but not very clear sight distance from the temple itself, from the Temple Mount, right? So when Jesus expires in verse 37, that is the Greek, breathes his last. The corresponding actions are the curtain of the temple is torn in two from top to bottom, and the centurion can either be standing facing Jesus or standing facing the temple. So the centurion can either be reacting to the death of Jesus, as our English and translations in the NRSV kind of imply by saying who stood facing him. But it's also possible to take the centurion as looking at the temple. Because why would a pagan be looking at the temple? Of course, the Romans knew that the temple was the symbol of the religious heart of Judaism, and they took, in the war against Rome in 66 or 70, they took the trophies back from the Jerusalem temple and paraded them through Rome as we know, because we have the arch in which the menorah and the other sacred objects are displayed. But the attention of the centurion to the concomitant actions of the ripping of the curtain in two is very interesting. It's kind of an inclusio with the beginning of Mark's gospel. And the acclamation of the centurion matches the beginning of Mark's gospel itself. So you could say that the movement of the gospel is from the narrator in chapter 1, verse 1, to the acclamation by a pagan of the dying Jesus as God's son, which is a term that could be applied to emperors. But what's interesting about this is that this isn't an emperor in purple sitting on a throne. This is a man in agony, expiring. So the centurion is representing an adjustment in comprehension, either way, either whether he's looking at the temple or whether he's looking at the dying Jesus. That was what I was meaning. Is that a bit clearer?
Right, and it would be the centurion that would be making the connection between there'd be like a triangulation between the temple, the curtain in the temple tearing, Jesus dying, and the identification of him as son of God.
Right.
Which is a Caesarian, it's associated with a Caesar, right?
Yes, a
Kurios.
Yes,
right.
Yes. But it would be an unusual way to acclaim anyone in the context of emperors wearing purple and garlands of victory and so on. So clearly, what Mark is trying to do is redefine the meaning of sonship by talking about the suffering and dying that Jesus is undergoing, as was predicted in Mark 8, 9, and 10, when three times he teaches of the suffering of the Son of Man. This is rejected by the disciples each time, so it has to be repeated. So to drive home the understanding of the suffering of Jesus, that this must take place, This is not simple enthronement or aggrandizement or being uplifted. The suffering is part of the meaning of sonship, of human identity of Jesus in Mark's gospel.
I had a second question, but I feel like I feel like I've been too directive of the conversation so far, so I'll hold off on that.
Go ahead, please, Josh. There's some things I'm thinking through, inspired by what Deirdre has shared and listening to your question. So please go ahead.
Okay. It was just a clarifying question about the grammar of aorist passive. So the way you translate it was the state of having been raised up as it refers to me, or something along those lines.
Yes.
I guess my question is, the way this is translated is I am raised up.
Yes.
Is Jesus the subject of that raising in that grammatical construction in the way that it's translated here? Or are we talking more like, I don't know exactly how to describe it, but that there is almost like there is a state of rising that is associated with me, or I am the one that is being raised? Those seem slightly different connotations.
That's right. I'm driving at the former. There is a state of being raised that is affected by God.
Mm-hmm.
And that state of being raised we know about from the Maccabees, from other places where this notion about afterlife in the form of resurrection is attributed to the agency of God and affected by God on other people. In other words, there's no agency of the human that has anything to do with resurrection. Indeed, the narrative of the false witnesses in the trial narrative is, he said, I will rise after 3 days, which is exactly why it's not possible to attribute that statement to Jesus and why we know it's the testimony of false witness, because resurrection is about the complete lack of human agency, and it what it demonstrates is the power of God.
Right. So the construction of I will raise is Jesus as the agent of the raising.
Yes.
Here, there is a condition that which God establishes that applies to Jesus.
Yes. Or Maccabees, or people who are unjustly killed. People who are unjustly killed. It has to do not just with whim, but it has to do with what has transpired is the death of people killed unjustly. And in order to rectify that unjust result, God effects resurrection. This is what we see in the case of the Maccabees, where seven brothers were killed for their faith. And lastly, their mother. And resurrection was effected by God on each of them in turn.
And in opposition to colonial rule.
And in opposition to Antiochus Epiphanes. Yes, absolutely. The Syrian ruler who was the source of oppression. Yes, exactly. And thought to be, you know, capable of demonstrating as much power as was available. But guess what? Apparently not.
Right, and the association between these two and the political situation, I think, is a key element of what is going on there.
I don't think that this is a direct reference to Maccabees. I'm just using Maccabees as an example. Yeah, yeah. In other words, the notion of resurrection is not found in the older texts of Hebrew scriptures. The notion that people would be resurrected comes into being in the Second Temple period for all sorts of reasons that have to do with the context of exile in which Israelites found themselves in other cultures, which encouraged them to engage in ideas about afterlife. And so we see in the book of Daniel, we see in the book of Enoch, 1 Enoch, 2 Enoch, notions of afterlife coming into being for certain righteous individuals. And then this notion of resurrection passes in, I'm going to wildly generalize, into Pharisaic Judaism, but not Sadduceic Judaism, right? Because Sadducees are, you know, pretty traditional, and it wasn't there in Hebrew scriptures, therefore no innovation for us. But the Sadducees, you know, did not survive much after the war against Rome in 66 to 70, but the Pharisees did. So that's why we get notions of afterlife. I'm afraid I'm generalizing too much.
Well, I do know that John Levinson argues that this idea of resurrection, the resurrection of the righteous, is even though it's contested within Judaism, is, you know, his point is like, well, it's a natural outgrowth of you know, basic Judaism. I'm not qualified to speak to that. I just do know that he makes that argument, and so I think some generalization is there's some authoritative basis for making that generalization.
And nobody would accuse John Levinson of being radical.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So we're on solid ground here, in good company. Right.
I wonder. Just adding to what you've just said, but picking up on an earlier point, I was happy, Deirdre, that you noted that it's the centurion who declares, who makes this sort of book and a declaration about this man was God's son, and that's a kind of evaluative comment, and that also might have some contrast to how the emperors or emperor of the time might have been understood. Mm-hmm. The divinity of emperors, the sonship of emperors. I thought I heard a bit of a political note infused in what you were saying about the power of the resurrection, the meaning of it, the diffusing of powers, of imperial powers in light of the resurrection. And that's something I haven't given a lot of thought to with respect to this passage. And I wondered, am I hearing that right? Is there any traction that can be gotten? So right alongside the theological connections, the theological understandings of resurrection, that there is a historical contextualizing of it that also has at least an innuendo of politics in it.
I like your question. I know that that's how it works in the context of the Maccabees, because the strength of the conviction of the seven brothers and their mother against the most powerful ruler of the Hellenistic Syrian regime, Antiochus Epiphanes, their faith renders Antiochus Epiphanes speechless and impotent. Yes. So I know that that's how that particular book was written. I don't quite know how to read that in Mark's gospel, but I bet I could look at some people who have an ear to that kind of nuance and see what they say.
Yeah.
Because it's possible that what's so great about the Maccabean martyrs is that there are more than one of them. But here we have simply one crucified individual.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I mean, I think that could the idea of a political nuance might take some working out somewhere else. I do find it interesting, though, that the centurion stood looking in the direction of Jesus and talking about being able to see perhaps the temple and Jesus mm-hmm. from a vantage point simultaneously. Mm-hmm. It is the visual aspect that he saw that in this way he breathes his last.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether the seeing takes in audition as well. Does he have to be proximate or right. close by? Or right. it's just literally just that there is something that was happening in the temple that he witnessed, but he also was witness to how Jesus mm-hmm. breathed his last. That it is a centurion who does it. It's almost like having a Roman witness.
Yep.
Attestation yep. to the nature of the death.
Yeah. Yeah. You
know, but yeah. You know, you could have the witness, the centurion witnessing the entire thing. And just mm-hmm. standing there as someone who can report back to authorities in the Roman Imperium. But that's not how he ends up. He ends up witnessing to an ambiguous idea that locks into to the baptism of Jesus. Truly, yeah. this is God's son, my beloved son.
Yeah.
And now it's in the mouth of the centurion, witness to a Jewish idea and to a Roman idea simultaneously. Yep. There is something potent
yep.
in that.
And the two titles that are, I mean, you have the you know, he's crucified under the title King of the Jews, right? Which is I mean, that was applied to Herod, right?
Yes.
But he's a descendant from the Hasmoneans, right? Who are connected with the Maccabees. But is himself a puppet, right?
Yes,
of the Roman Empire, and has in many ways, I mean, you could say, like, betrayed that legacy, trying to kill children, slaughter children, and all kinds of things in order to secure his place. And there are lots of people that are, I guess what I mean is that, like, the religious and political situation here is very fraught with folks that are willing to compromise with Roman authority that make it analogous to the Antiochus situation. I'm not trying to overdraw the connections with the Maccabees, but to say that the to then have a Roman soldier apply an imperial title to this man that's being killed by the empire that seems really deeply, deeply resonant with those issues. I mean, they're taunting him, you know, if you really are king of the Jews, when you come down from the cross, and then to say, you know, it strikes me as like the stakes are that the narrative is raising the stakes very, very high, in that it really comes down to who is really the Lord in this situation, who is God.
Yes.
And
yes.
If Jesus is not raised, then you better believe that Caesar is Lord, mm-hmm. right? That seems like the stakes, at least in the world as the narrative of the gospel wants to present it, as far as Jesus is concerned. And you have somebody who's devoted his life to the empire, recognizing the opposite in his death, right? So I think that would be like the thing, like one of the things that Bultmann always talks about is like the cross and resurrection are one event. there's a way in which you can't really understand the significance of his resurrection apart from seeing like having the eyes to see how the pieces converge in a certain way in his death on a cross.
Yeah, you know, I'm also thinking with the idea of hidden discourse in the telling of these stories, in the remembering of the crucifixion. This is something that I have no real solid ground to stand on. So I'll just flag that and acknowledge it right up front. But there's a way in which we can discuss, say, the crucifixion narratives for their historicity, as a record of an event. But I'm also thinking with the work of narratives, and that our Gospels were not written in a vacuum, just sort of the vacuum being the community that is interested in Jesus and the Jesus story, and this really critical part of the Jesus story, but that they were communities. I think back to Burton Mack's work, Myth of Innocence, which he especially uses with respect to mark that these are not innocent stories, that they do more than provide details, that they function, I'm struggling for the words, but they function not only to inform the community about what Jesus is about, but to inform the community what they are about in the context where they are emerging, in relation to the empire, and they are emerging in relation to the Jewishness in which the Gospels are embedded. Mm-hmm. So, and this is where I don't have any grounds to stand on or to move forward with, to even ask the question, if this story is heard not only by the Markan community, but it's repeated and told amongst people who are living in the Roman Empire. What do they hear when you have this kind of core confrontation with imperial presence around the resurrection? You know, what can we, Will Gaffney talks about sanctified imagination. And there was in class last night, we were talking not only about sanctified imagination, we invoke that trope, but midrashic interpretation, which permits of reading between the lines. But to read between the lines in Gaffney's terms requires the use of this, what she calls a sanctified imagination. Some would just say cultural imagination. What would the hearers, the original hearers of this narrative, understand? Would they take it as a simple report, or would they see a hidden transcript? And how would that transcript work for galvanizing them, inspiring them, moving them as they worked out their discipleship?
Yep. If Mark is the first gospel, we know how Mark is used in Matthew and Luke.
Yeah.
And with regard to the ending, what Matthew and Luke do is they expand the ending dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So their imaginations move in the direction of different traditions, but around the same narrative, right?
Yeah.
So Matthew expands in terms of really quite cataclysmic apocalyptic events that accompany the resurrection. Just before Jesus dies, the bodies of saints rise out of graves and appear to people in the holy city of Jerusalem. You see what I'm doing with your imagination, Althea? I'm trying to say that that there is evidence that this may be what happens to Mark's gospel when people reflect on it.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that actually, if that is what happens with Mark's gospel, I think, using broad strokes, there's a way in which biblical literature does this to each other in terms of intertextuality.
Yep.
It's just that I think my tentativeness, it's because that is not how we understand biblical interpretation to be, biblical exegesis to be properly done.
Yeah.
But there is an incipient midrashic approach.
Yeah.
In the way different books of the scriptures take each other's narratives up and embellish them. But it also has then implications, I think. Even as I said it, I was pondering, what does that have to do with preaching? But I then think again in terms of a big picture which needs to be grounded in our present realities. You know, it's where do we place ourselves when we lift up these stories for congregations? You know, is it in that this is a report of history? Does this represent a dialectical or a dialogical relationship with the context? What are the tensions that we could discern between the Markan narrative and what's happening in the empire at the time? How does that translate into how congregations, denominations locate themselves in relationship to the whatever the prevailing authority in a context is? There's lots of little pieces that then need to be worked out if we can even, and I think we can, point to this use of sanctified imagination in the gospel context, as you were, but gospel literature, as you just mentioned it, but also as part of a biblical template for how to relate to the text that you have.
And honestly, if we're going to do that kind of a thing, which we will do if we're going to preach, teach, or proclaim, then this is the place to start doing it. Because this is about the potential of radical challenge and radical imagination and radical transformation of the meaning of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
not just for individuals, but for communities, for communities, right? So you open that up, Althea, and your invitation is one into which we should step with boldness. Step with boldness.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. There's something so very powerful about remembering a story like this in the way that it's remembered in Mark. Because now I'm sort of elaborating on something that you both have said. In your boldness, the empire cannot kill you.
Yeah.
As a community, yeah. There's life that you might suffer, but this is in the context of Easter. We're just going to suffer for 3 days. You know, it's going to be a resurrection. So yeah, be bold.
Yeah.
Be bold in how you remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
On that note, we should probably stop because you have things to do and places to be. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Look forward to next week.
All right.
Be safe, be well. Goodbye, everybody.